Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of BRAF Mutant Metastatic Melanoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Axel Halschild from the University Hospital in Kiel, Germany. In addition to this interview program, there's also a corresponding presentation program with Dr. Halschild's slides. To begin, I asked him for his thoughts on the recent FDA pan-tumor approval of dabrafenib-trametinib. In the United States, recently there was an FDA pan-tumor approval for dab-trem. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are about that.
You're right. So I think that's really something interesting. And we have something like this also for pembrolizumab for tumors which have tumor mutation burden of more than 10 mutations per megabase. So it's you know, pan-tumor indication. I need to say now a conflict of interest. My conflict of interest here is I'm a dermato-oncologist. I know some other diseases like thyroid cancer, some rare diseases also, which contain BRAF mutations, including 5% of colorectal cancers. And therefore, I was knowing that BRAF and MEK inhibitors can work here in those patients, but not eventually not in the same magnitude as in melanoma. So in melanoma, it's truly a driving mutation. And therefore, I appreciate a pan-tumor registration for BRAF and MEK inhibitors because, you know, companies are unlikely willing to go for niche indications because it's not an orphan, at least not by the definition of the European medical agencies. You know, and therefore it's very tough if you need to find arguments and you need to write applications for insurance companies for these niche indications. So it's highly appreciated, this approval.
I mean, you can always try to find data. Like I was saying, I think you see BRAF positive myelomas, but I mean, there are data out there you can look at in some situations. But the reason I was asking you is that, you know, particularly in colon cancer, you know, it's not the same story. It doesn't work quite, you know, as well. You have to use an EGFR antibody. So I was just kind of surprised at that. I was curious what your thoughts were about that. Another thing I wanted to ask you about, at the end, you mentioned the issue of the patient who had adjuvant therapy and then develops metastatic disease. Could you just briefly review what we know about the use of adjuvant targeted therapy in melanoma, as well as what we know in terms of IO, and how you think it's you would think through a patient who then relapses after that?
Yeah, the very important point. Thank you very much for this question. So, you know, adjuvant stage 3 treatment allows us to use for BRAF mutated patients a BRAF and MEK inhibitor, namely dabrafenib and trametinib. It was a combi AD trial leading to approval with a hazard ratio of roughly 0.50. Even after 5 years, the data are looking very good. We performed a cure rate model, which shows that 17% of patients, 1-7, can be cured by the adjuvant treatment. So that's overwhelmingly good data. And for the IO treatment with PD-1, either nivolumab or pembrolizumab, the hazard ratio compared to placebo is in a range of 0.60. So very much the same. Very good data. So adjuvant treatment in stage 3 is standard of care. The question is, what happens after immediate progressive disease on this adjuvant treatment? And we have surveys, we have data from real world, which have been published. And we all know that somebody who has been treated with BRAF and MEK inhibitors and progresses while the treatment is given is not a good candidate for BRAF and MEK inhibitors, let's say after progression to stage 4 disease. So everybody would agree to treat with IO. The other way around holds true as well. If you are pre-treated with a PD-1 antibody, you would not give a PD-1 antibody after progressive disease immediately, but a significant proportion of patients, roughly 50% in Germany, would receive ipilimumab nivolumab. So PD-1 failures may receive the combo immune checkpoint inhibition. The difficult question is, what happens to patients who completed 1 year of adjuvant treatment, either with TT or IO? They have more than half a year of being disease-free, and thereafter progress, let's say, to stage 4. And here we are uncertain if we can give a re-challenge. In Germany, we have a survey, very few would give a re-challenge to the same drugs. we would switch to from I/O to TT or from TT to I/O. But, you know, for stage four, because ipi/nivo showed so good results, there is a significant proportion of patients who would be treated by German dermoncs after failure to anti-PD-1 with ipi/nivo. So not everybody would receive in stage four Dabtrum or any other BRAF and MEK inhibitor. Many receive ipi/nivo because the data in stage four look pretty good. So we need to say we are living now in a different world. We have 70% of our patients in Germany, if they reach stage four classification, they are no longer treatment naive. And this is changing the field of treatment completely.
Are there trials looking at ENCO-BINI in the adjuvant setting?
That is the next story on stage two. And in stage two, you know, we have an approved scheme since 4 months. It's pembrolizumab for stage two B and C. We expect to see the data on another randomized phase three pivotal clinical trial on nivolumab at the Society of Melanoma Research meeting on October 17th. So we have eventually two schemes which work nicely, but there is one clinical trial, and this is the Columbus AD trial on encorafenib and binimetinib for BRAF mutated patients for stage 2 B and C. I like this clinical trial because BRAF and MEK inhibitors work nicely in stage 3. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't work in stage 2 B and C. And the toxicity profile is certainly something very promising, because in stage 3, we didn't have sequelae from the treatment, which means there were no long-term toxicities. And this is a major advantage over the PD-1 antibodies. So I'm a steering committee member of the Columbus AD. And, you know, it's hard to sell a placebo-controlled trial if you have pembrolizumab approved already. But those patients who have a fear for adverse events, they might be happy with a scheme of ENCO-BINI compared to oral placebos. So for those patients, ideally, you know, they are candidates, and hopefully some others, because we need the testing of BRAF inhibitors and BRAF and MEK inhibitors in combination in stage two urgently.
Are there data with ENCO-BINI in stage three?
No, there's no clinical trial. And I don't believe that the sponsoring company will set up a clinical trial in stage three, because there's so much competition in the field. Three approved regimens, one of those is a BRAF and MEK inhibitor. You can be at best a me too. But in our days, it would be absolutely impossible to compare ENCO-BINI to a placebo. So you need to compare to Dabtrum, you know, and then you need 10,000 patients to show a 3% of a difference, if there's a difference at all, for them in the stage 3 adjuvant setting. So I would have my doubts. I think it's mission impossible.
But this trial that's going to be presented, the data has not been presented yet. It's the first time it's coming out.
Yes, exactly. And the data are strictly confidential. And I think for me, it's unlikely that the data are different from the Pembro, because adjuvant Pembro and Nivo stage 3 was the same. Stage 4, Pembro and Nivo showed the same data basically and the same long-term survival. So why should this be a negative clinical trial? So my expectation, it's a positive trial, and I was seeing a press release which already indicated a positive trial. So we don't have the exact data right now, but I assume to see the same magnitude of a benefit and the same sort of activities as for Pembro.
So assuming that's what you would expect, I guess one question would be, how would you feel about switching from Dabtrem to ENCO-BINI in a patient who's getting adjuvant Dabtrem and having a problem with toxicity?
I love this question again. So yeah, you are really challenging me with good questions. So, you know, this is what is done in Germany, 90% of patients. If we use Dabtrem
really?
In stage three, yes, we have a survey on it. And almost every colleague is switching. We like to give something different, and we have a new name for the drug, and eventually the patient is hoping for a new efficacy, And therefore, in almost every center in Germany, we switched to another drug regimen. So it's unlikely that a patient who showed a progressive disease under Dr. Trump, even if during the one-year treatment period there was no PD, that this patient receives Dr. Trump again in Germany would switch most likely to encorbini because the significant toxicities and the decreasing interest in dermato-oncology of the sponsoring company.
I was kind of following this. Everything kind of made sense. And then DreamSeq came along, and that was kind of interesting. And then you talked about the update that was presented at ASCO. So I'd like you to chat a little bit more about that. And then I want to ask you about this presentation from ESMO in terms of biomarkers, because that was another thing that I wasn't really expecting. Very interesting. So let's start out with DreamSeq. I think it was like a ESMO virtual with Mike Atkins to start out with first, and then there was more data presented at ASCO. Can you kind of go back through what they looked at there, what the idea was behind it, and from your point of view, what the main, you know, outcomes were and what it meant?
So Dream Sequence showed clearly that the combo of ipilimumab and nivolumab is superior to initial treatment with Daptrum, and I was telling you already that the response rate was surprisingly low for Daptrum as first-line treatment. But the data are the data, and I have no doubt if we are consider now overall survival, which was a primary endpoint, overall survival at 2 years, and there's a difference of 23%. So I wouldn't ask any further question now because the data are strikingly different, and OS is an endpoint which is so clean. The big surprise was the low response rate for Daptrum and the high response rate in second line and the low PFS in first line and the meaningful PFS in second line. So it looks like the BRAF and MEK inhibitors are doing a good job in second line. It was also an outcome which was not unexpected, but which was really interesting.
Well, let me ask you though, in the first line, the response rate was 43%, I think. What were you expecting?
I was expecting 67 to 70%. So that was a gap of 25%, which is very difficult to explain.
You know, on the other hand, I think it was like 114 patients. And I know that's not enough to completely explain it, but still, it's not a huge number of patients. What do you think about that?
I don't think that the number of patients was so important. It could well be that the patient characteristics are making the difference. But I went through all patients' characteristics looking for a particularly high number of high LDH patients or some other unfavorable prognostic factors which could explain a low response rate. But I didn't find it. It was well balanced between the two arms, and it was the regular pattern of prognostic factors which you see in many other clinical trials.
Let me ask you, and this starts to tie into this ESMO data, that, at least in my mind, anyhow, I don't know. Do you think that maybe part of what was observed there was the maybe unexpected beneficial effect of the second line targeted therapy, that maybe having had an IO previously in some way enhanced second line? Do you think what do you think the explanation is basically of why we saw that?
It's a very good point. And there was a rumor already in the field for 10 years that if you, I would call it prime patients with IO, you know, and then you give the targeted therapies, you may have a synergistic benefit. And you may have what we would call a triplet or a quadrilapse. So if you have four drugs, and you know, again, you know, it could well be because you don't need to wait after the progressive disease for a washout period of 4 weeks or so. You can give it immediately, that you have a synergistic benefit if you give one after the other one. And this would be my explanation.
Incidentally, not to get too far out on a topic, but we're doing a webinar later with Passiani on EGFR, and one of the things that comes out in lung cancer is they have a lot of concerns about using targeted therapy right after IOs, like what you were just talking about. You got this patient progress on IO, you start the Daptrem. Well, this really came more out of like the EGFR targeted therapy, like osimertinib, where they were seeing pneumonitis. But then the docs in practice, they got all nervous about giving targeted therapy to a patient in general who had recent IO. Do you think that specifically they should be worried about BRAF after IO?
I wouldn't say so, because we have other examples. I'll give you another example from another cancer entity, which is cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. There's a nice ASCO presentation 2021 on sequential scheme, and there's another one from Italy this year. When targeted therapies have been given immediately after IO for cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas, and you know, there was a surprisingly high rate of cetuximab given after IO for cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas, the best rate I have ever seen. A single agent activity is typically 23%, and here was 50 or 60% response rate if you give it immediately after IO. So you can discuss again if IO is priming for better response rates. And we have seen the same with chemotherapy in a real-world evaluation in melanoma. After IO, you might see surprisingly good responses for chemo. So give it a try, and I would not worry about the adverse events.
So we talked about the DREAMseq trial. But the other thing I wanted to ask, I wonder whether it's relevant or not, was this data that was just presented at ESMO on biomarker analysis from the Columbus Part 1 study. Because if I understand this correctly, it looks like there's a relationship between TMB and also PD-1 levels and benefit from targeted therapy. Is my understanding that correctly? And the high PD-1, the high TMB did better with targeted therapy.
Yes, that's true, but it was better with targeted therapy, but it was not compared to IO. So the same holds true for IO. So basically, it's a predictor for better outcome, therefore a prognostic factor, but it's not a predictor of IO versus targeted therapies, because you see for the targeted combinations as well as for IO, always are the best of the best results for those patients with high PD-L1 expression and with high tumor mutation burden. And for tumor mutation burden, this has been published by Ya Chuan and co-workers December 2018 in New England Journal of Medicine. You see a clear relationship in all tumors for high TMB and high response rate and low TMB. The worst example is, by the way, uveal melanoma with almost zero TMB and almost zero response rate to a conventional immune checkpoint inhibition.
So you're saying that in general, melanoma responds better to checkpoint therapy with a high TMB and a high PD-1?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Because I kind of vaguely remember when the first, you know, some of the first phase 3 studies came out comparing, I think it was ipi-nivo to nivo, that it seemed like in that early thing that people with, I think it was low PD-1 did better with the combination, and then everybody just didn't pay any attention to it and started using ipi-nivo. And hey, that's the way it looked to me, but I don't know. Is that kind of the, but you're saying that in fact, it turns out that PD-1 and TMB are predictive of checkpoint benefit in melanoma?
Yeah, it was not the question. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, ipi-nivo and rela-nivo shows the same pattern. The combos work best in PD-L1 negative patients. So you may argue that this is the right setting, but you can say it the other way around. Single agent anti-PD-1 is good enough in high PD-L1 expressors. So it's not an indicator for not working nicely the combo in PD ligand 1. It's simply the distinction what works best in this particular setting. And it's ipi-nivo for high expressors as well, but it's not different to nivo. And this was a surprise, you know, that the PD ligand 1 antibodies are doing a great job in high PD ligand 1 expressors. And we may only need the combos for those who have low expression. But honestly, in Germany, we are not doing it in the routine PD-L1 measurement. So we need to implement it to our guidelines and bring it to the routines. If rela-nivo is approved only for PD-L1 negative patients, we have no lung cancer, which we treat in dermato-oncology. For us, it's completely new. We know all the discussion on PD-L1 values and how it's done and the TPS score and differences in the antibodies. So it's quite a complex discussion, which might be ongoing if the drug is on the market. But I told you, right now, Rela Nevo is not on the market, so we have no issue with PD ligand 1 testing.
Yeah, no, when I brought this up over the years, people have always bring up this issue of the quality control of PD-1 and all that. I mean, they figure something out in lung cancer, so I don't know. But the thing that's confusing me is why you would see a difference in targeted outcome from targeted therapy based on these immune markers. Any thoughts about why?
Absolutely, yes, because it has been shown by Tony Rivas from Los Angeles and other groups very early on that with BRAF/MEK inhibition, you have an immune stimulation and you see an influx of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. You see a higher expression of PD ligand 1 in the tumor cells. So they have some immune properties, the BRAF and MEK inhibitors. It's not only a targeted agent, which is targeted against BRAF, but it's also immunostimulatory agents. So you can say BRAF and MEK inhibition is some sort of immunotherapy as well.
I want to kind of go back through a bunch of the things that you went through that I was like, I want to hear more about. And another thing, you put up a graphic from a Nature paper, 2011. T cells are controlled by many factors. And you said, oh, we presented this graphic a million times, but I personally don't remember seeing it, although my memory's not that great. But I thought it was really interesting. I didn't realize they're like inhibitory and activating receptors. Can you kind of explain that? Because I don't remember hearing about that. But anyhow, if you could, like LAG-3, CTLA-4, PD-1, TIM-3s, all over on the inhibitory side. And then you got a whole bunch of other ones on the activating. Can you kind of explain that?
I can't explain it, but I can only say it is like it is. And this, by the way, findings got the Nobel Prize 3 years ago by Jim Allison from the United States and Takatsuko Honyo from Japan. So they discovered the immune checkpoint, and they found out there's inhibitory and stimulatory molecules. And they were also the pioneers of developing anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1. And now it's anti-LAG-3. So three on the side of the inhibitory molecules made it to approvals, and none on the activating side. And I know some examples of more, let's say, intense adverse events on the activating side. So there was a problem with toxicities of some of these molecules and leading to too much of immunostimulation, causing a cytokine storm syndrome. And therefore, one of the reasons might be the inferior tolerability of the activation of the activating receptors of the immune checkpoint.
One of the things that you commented on a few times in your talk was the issue of patients who are not good candidates for immunotherapy, people with autoimmune problems, prior transplants, et cetera. And of course, that's been a hotly debated point in general in oncology. In general, right now, how do you approach that situation, both in the adjuvant setting and in the metastatic setting, in terms of patients who you really don't want to give checkpoint inhibitors to, or maybe you would, but you'd rather delay it? Maybe you can talk a little bit about how you approach both things like transplant as well as autoimmune problems.
Yeah. So patients with an underlying autoimmune disease are typically not treated with PD-1 antibodies in the adjuvant setting. It's a question on the risk benefit. And I need to say here I see the risk is dominating unless it's stage 3C, stage 3D, so the high risk of the stage 3 proportion of patients. So it depends on the tumor stage. Number one. And secondly, it depends on the underlying autoimmune disease. If it's going along with the constant immunosuppression and the high dose of corticosteroids or other immunosuppressants. So, and then after careful discussion of pros and cons with the patient is making the decision at the end of the day. So it's some patients may take the risk of an exacerbation of the underlying autoimmune disease and others not. We had today a tumor conference in our center, and we had two such patients. One of them is an organ transplant recipient of a renal gland as well as a pancreas. And in this patient, we discussed adjuvant treatment. And we had the conclusion that the risk is by far too high and it's not a candidate. So we were just giving, after standard surgery for lymph node metastasis, a recommendation towards an adjuvant irradiation. So an adjuvant setting is very tough. So it's more the trend to not give immunostimulatory molecules. In stage four, if patients have no chance, you may say, well, you know, you may lose your organ like the renal gland. You go back to dialysis, that's an opportunity. We can stop the immunosuppressive medication and then you can pray to God that the ipi-nivo treatment is doing a good job. But very, very difficult discussion, and you need to involve the organ transplant specialists from surgery as well and discuss it. And it's a very individual one-on-one discussion with a patient and eventually with the relatives of the patient.
So I want to get to your cases also, but I want to ask you a few more things about things that you discussed in your talk. One was a slide from the ESMO 2020 consensus, which was I hadn't seen before and was kind of interesting. Treating patients with BRAF mutant melanoma and concomitant therapies. So you've got on this slide, anti-epileptics with strong effect on CYP and with no effect on CYP. Then you've got corticosteroids under 4 milligrams, over 4 milligrams. And under each, there's a bunch of comments in terms of how it affects treatment choice. Yeah. Can you kind of go through that in terms of, I don't know, how you would, if you were walking down the hall making rounds with your fellows, how you would explain that?
Yeah, I can explain it very simply. You know, ipilimumab nivolumab is in our German guideline and this European guideline treatment of choice. So if you have multiple brain mets, it's a treatment of choice. If you have a single brain met, you would go for stereotactic irradiation or neurosurgery. But for the multiple mets, it's very clear. If you have symptomatic patients who need an early stop of all the symptoms, you may consider targeted therapies as the first choice. They are doing a great job in terms of response rate. The question is response durability. And there they are inferior to ipilimumab, nivolumab. So you can argue on a sequential scheme, for instance. Regarding immunosuppression, we know that patients who receive a high dose of corticosteroids as concomitant medication have zero chance to respond from immune checkpoint inhibition. We would always give a favor to the targeted therapies.
So just to be clear, though, because in the past, it hasn't been that clear to me that there was a lot of data. People talked about the theoretical concern of corticosteroids. Are there actual data where you can show the immunotherapy doesn't work as well?
Yes, there is a number of data. And we had multi-cohort trials from Australia, from the United States, and an international one. And one of the cohorts was always patients who are symptomatic. They have an inferior prognosis and an inferior chance for a response. But also there was subgroups of patients who were treated with high-dose corticosteroids. And what you see is the response rate is not zero, but it's very, very low, let's say 10% at best. And therefore, you know, it's not the best setting to give the immunotherapeutic drugs here. But still, you know, the targeted agents are doing a job here. But the responses are not very long-lasting.
So one other question before we get into your cases, which is, I wonder if you could chat a little bit about the kinds of side effects and toxicities you see with Encobini and Dabtrem and how you prevent and manage those.
Yeah. So adverse event management of Encobini and Dabtrem is relatively easy because we have very strict guidelines, not only nationwide, but also international accepted guidelines. We were learning a lot from the clinical trials. For Dabtrem, the only issue is the fever management, and we learned you need to stop both. The dapirolizumab and the trametinib, both at the same time. Don't continue with just the MEK inhibitor because it's not bringing an advantage to the patient, but it's causing more toxicity. And we have stepwise reduction of the drugs, and you can come back to the last dose level. And all of this has been defined very well. There's the fever management scheme from Australia, from Sydney, to be precise, and this has been implemented into all guidelines. So I don't think that adverse event management in our days is a big problem unless you have very rare adverse events particularly cutaneous adverse events. But, you know, then you need to consult your dermatologist.
So you kind of lump together Encobini and Dabtrim, but what do you actually see with Encobini? I mean, do you see fevers?
We see fever, but the proportion of patients with fever is significantly lower than for Dabtrim. That's one of the issues. But there is fever, as for vimorafenib and cobimetinib. So it's not that there's 0% of patients with fever, but the fever is less intense and certainly not be dose-limiting in the vast majority of patients. What you see is a bit of fatigue. You know, you may see some nausea and some diarrhea. And, you know, this kind of management is very easy for anyone. You can go for dose reductions, which is always the best choice, and for conventional treatment of diarrhea.
I've heard cases described to me of people, I think I can remember with Dabtrim, who like would have sort of chronic fevers, and the doc would say, I'm going to give you some corticosteroids. When you have the fever, take the corticosteroids, and they would do that for months. I remember Jeff Weber telling me about cases like that. Is that something you do with your patients also? Do you have people who just, you know, take steroids or no?
No, I wouldn't give corticosteroids for a long time because you're also suppressing the tumor microenvironment, and I would stop the medication. It's not the right medication for this patient.
Yeah, no, so they stopped it.
And in the adjuvant setting, those patients who stop the treatment in the adjuvant phase 3 setting, stage 3, they did as good as a patient who continued for 1 year. So we don't know what the right duration of treatment is. I would stop this patient and discontinue completely. If this is stage 4 and the patient has still tumors present, then you need to switch to another BRAF and MEK inhibitor scheme with less likelihood of fever.
You know, this scenario would be like they would get intermittent fevers and the doc would say, just take the corticosteroids for a couple of days and it would go away and the patient would do well for years like that. Do you have any patients like that?
Yeah, I have patients, but, you know, we would typically stop. What I learned over the last 10 years with BRAF and MEK inhibitors is you need to stop those patients because a constant immunosuppression is not good. And even fever, CTC grade 1-2, for half a year or so is unacceptable for patients. Why not stop and wait and see? And this is my personal policy. I wouldn't go for any sort of immunosuppression or fever medication day by day.
All right, let's talk about your cases.
This is a patient, a 52-year-old male, in January 2017, an ulcerated melanoma metastasis in the left groin, which showed a BRAF mutation and not a clearly identified primary tumor. I show you a lesion in a second, which might be the primary tumor, but even our dermatologist or pathologist was uncertain about it. If it's a melanoma, it's a melanoma in more or less complete regression. And you see it here. So this is most likely the primary tumor on the back of the patient. So this is a lesion which showed a huge size. I haven't seen these cases very often in the last years, but it happens, and it was neglected by the patient. And the patient was told by his medical oncologist in the periphery that he is not treatable by conventional treatment modalities. And I strongly disagreed, because we were knowing that these large lesions might still be a target for targeted therapies, but the target would be BRAF. And we were crossing our fingers that this lesion is harboring a BRAF mutation. And you see the very impressive CT scan, and the further staging examination showed multiple lymph node metastasis in the groin and paraileocal lymph nodes. And, you know, the growth of the tumor was comprising the large vessels in the left leg. And so this was a consecutive thrombosis of the left leg, lymphedema, and you were already seeing the penile edema, and there was a lung arterial embolism found by chance in both lower lungs. No other organ involvement, so it was just the bulky lymph node metastases. So the discussion in the tumor board was, what kind of treatment options do we have available for the patient? And it is typical discussion, either chemo, immuno, target therapies, radiation therapy, or surgery. And we opted in for a BRAF and MEK inhibitor. So the start of the treatment in March 2017 was with daprodustat and trametinib with approved dosing schedule. And we saw an S100, which is a regular test in Germany as a very sensitive and specific melanoma marker in the serum. You see the upper normal limits in our institution were 0.11. And this is a 20-fold increased level, which is 2.51, which already shows that this is an extremely high level. Interestingly enough, and you see a discrepancy to LDH, the LDH levels were within normal range. So, bulky disease, daprodustat treatment. So the question now is what happens? And here you see it over only 4 weeks, what happened. Huge ulcerated tumor with some bleeding. You see the crusting on March 16th, and very impressively for the patient, but also for the treating physicians like me, 4 weeks later, you see a shrinkage of the tumor. And I would say that this is roughly 50% of the original size, if not more. And you see a crusting, it could well represent a necrosis. I will come back to this in a second. So we considered this as a partial remission. We conducted all the clinical imaging evaluations, and this has been confirmed. Also, the iliacal lymph nodes were in response. But, however, a new single brain metastasis was detected. So the patient was brought to the interdisciplinary tumor board of our institution again. And here you see the lesion in the MRI of the brain. And I would say that every oncologist could identify this easily. And the question was, what is the tumor board now deciding? So we were deciding first to continue BRAF and MEK inhibitor therapy because the response was so overwhelming and it was not a complete response. In this case, we might discuss to stop, but even in this case, in our days, we wouldn't stop. And we continued BRAF and MEK inhibitor treatment for another 3 months. And here you see how nicely the lesion is regressing. And you see that there is some pigment remaining, and later on I will show you that we are for sure taking biopsies, but also the penile edema was gone, but the edema of the leg remained, and this is most likely not only due to the tumor, but also to the thrombosis of this leg. Here is the lesion again. It was confirmed, little larger, but not very aggressively in growth, and therefore we discussed it again in the interdisciplinary tumor board. Partial remission, eventually it's already a CR, but we were not taking biopsies at this point of time. We were taking them a little later. There was a progressive growth of the single brain met, and so the tumor board decision was made for a switch to ipilimumab, nivolumab, with continuation treatment of nivolumab. And I told you in Germany we are always going for full dose of ipilimumab with 3 mg/kg. Four times in a 3-week schedule for the first 3 months. The treatment was initiated. And the hope at this point of time was already that the single brain met, which showed only a minor progression, will also disappear with the treatment. So the patient developed diarrhea of CTC grade 3, fatigue and weight loss. So typical adverse events seen typically regarding the diarrhea after 3 cycles of ipilimumab, nivolumab. And we are using in Europe, and not only in Germany, calprotectin in the stool measurement. You see the normal value is 50 mg per kg. This patient had 2,700, which is a very, very good parameter to detect an autoimmune colitis. And the stool microbiology showed no evidence for any bacterial infections. And the colonoscopy confirmed the autoimmune colitis. So typical adverse events seen after 3 cycles of ipi/nivo. Treatment was, as outlined in all our guidelines, systemic methylprednisolone, 2 mg/kg body weight, and I need to say it here again, if there is colitis of this grade 3, we never give just 1 mg, we start with 2 mg, and the continuation of the therapy was with nivolumab. So what you see here is in January 2018, an overwhelming response, a complete regression of the brain map just by ipilimumab and nivolumab. So we were saying to ourselves it was a good decision to, to postpone the stereotactic irradiation. And you see a fantastic results over time in the groin, you know. And now the question certainly was appearing if we need to take a biopsy to confirm the response. And this biopsy was taken in January 2019. There was two biopsies taken here, and the histology evaluated in our dermatologist, the pathology lab, showed just melanophages. So there was no melanocytes, no melanoma cells, and we were believing there is no melanoma left here. So no signal in the MRI and CT scannings, and in the histology, no melanoma cells. So it was not a big surprise. I have seen something like this before, caused by immunotherapy, that the melanophages are remaining for some time before they completely disappear. It's a re-examination, complete remission in the left groin, no evidence of disease in the brain, and we continued for 39 infusions of nivolumab, and the patient is progression-free since the last evaluation in August this year. And we now discuss with the patient if we are maintaining with six-monthly staging examinations, or if we can go for long intervals. So far, we go for six-monthly evaluations. In the early phases, we had three-monthly evaluations. So I think this is a very, very impressive case. And here you see the final results from the very beginning to the end. And I think it's a good example that you should never give up. And if that is a good prognostic indicator, if a patient has a BRAF mutation in his tumor, because it opens up for primary BRAF and MEK inhibitor treatment, but also secondary BRAF and MEK inhibitor treatment, which we call in our days a rechallenge. Well, with this, I like to continue with the second case. It's a complex case. And in this case, it shows the medical history of our 40-year-old female patient. You see a lesion which is not really looking like a melanoma, because it was widely amelanotic, but it was a melanoma of 2.4 millimeter tumor thickness. The central node was positive. At this time, the patient received a completion of lymphadenectomy, which we are not doing in our days, after just a positive central node, and an adjuvant interferon treatment, which was standard of care in Germany in the year 2013, when the patient has been discussed in the tumor board. So it was AGCC classification, stage 3, and this is an X-ray, or it's a CT to be precise, from October 2020. I go back. This shows August 2013. So in between, the stage 3B patient was disease-free. Nothing happened. The interferon treatment has been terminated. And in April 2015, and for 5.5 years, the patient remained disease-free before she appeared with some symptoms. And you are not surprised if you see this scan that the patient is symptomatic. There was massive dyspnea, anemia, edema of the lower extremities, and deterioration of the general condition. So we graded her ECOG status as ECOG 4, so it was terrible. The patient was treated as an inpatient, and chest CT has been performed, and it detected a pleural carcinosis with disintegrated tumor mass and hemorrhagic effusion, and histologically metastatic melanoma was confirmed. Very high S100 and very high LDH. So it was very clear that this is stage 4 symptomatic melanoma patient, and this patient is not harboring a good prognosis if you see these baseline evaluations in October 2020. Honestly, if I look back on my 34-year-old career in melanoma, I need to say that these sort of patients would typically die within 3 to 4 months. And in the old days of chemotherapy, we would not be sure if we would offer for ECOG 4 patients a chemotherapy at all, or if we go immediately to best supportive care. So this patient had, luckily enough, a BRAF V600 mutation, and we discussed the following treatment options in our interdisciplinary tumor board. And I was in between targeted therapies, as in the first place, oral combined immune checkpoint therapy with ipilimumab and nivolumab. I believe this sort of patient has no other options. Don't go. I go back with PD-1 single agent treatment. Chemotherapy is not a good option. In the clinical trial, I can tell you nobody could treat such a patient with ECOG-4 in a clinical trial because it's not available for ECOG-4 patients. So it could only be targeted therapies or ipi-nivo. But if you have a patient with a very bad performance status, it's not the best choice to give ipilimumab in the first place. So we opted in for BRAF and MEK inhibitors. In this case, we were giving encorafenib and binimetinib with the approved dose, and we started on 2nd of November 2020, so almost 2 years ago. November 2020, the patient was on the palliative care unit for 3 weeks, and during this time, general condition improved significantly to ECOG-2, once again from ECOG-4 to ECOG-2. And I guess this is really good news even now, because we know from very many patients that an improvement of the general condition is linked to a regression of tumor masses. The dyspnea was gone. There was a reduction of the size of a lower extremity edema. Side effects? Yes, there was side effects. And the typical side effect is a cardiac toxicity. Not observed very often, but it's typical for BRAF and MEK inhibitors. And therefore, you always need an ECG and an echocardiography before you initiate the treatment. And this was done in our patient as well. And there was a reduction of the left ventricular ejection fraction compared to baseline, which was 70% to now 48%. And this is critical, you know. And we paused the binimetinib treatment, and which is very fair, till February 2021. And then we had another examination. And the partial remission was confirmed. So the lesions were decreasing. There was a complete regression of pleural effusion. No other metastasis detected and no brain mets. So that is really good news. That's good news. And what happened is, the comparison of October 2020 to February 2021, that this very obvious regression was going along with the decreased symptoms of the patient, and the patient got better and better. And we allowed the patient to be treated in an ambulatory setting after she was already on the palliative care unit. We shouldn't forget it. The tumor board in April 2021, so we continue with Encobini, considered this ongoing partial response as very good. And we have a fear to stop targeted therapies. We had a German evaluation, which was a pilot study, which showed that in patients, when we discontinued, in 50% of the patient, even if they had a complete response, they had a short time after the discontinuation of BRAF and MEK inhibitors, a rapidly progressive disease. Therefore, for us, it's different compared to immune checkpoint inhibitors, where I would say, well, let's maintain the complete response for 3 months, and then we can stop. For targeted therapies, we always give a recommendation for continuation of treatment unless we switch to some sort of immune checkpoint inhibition, to another drug. But, you know, here in this patient, we had a switch discussed, and we switched to combined immunotherapy with ipilimumab and nivolumab. The data for this are available from Secombit, a trial on sequential treatment conducted by the Italian key opinion leader Paolo Ascerto from Naples. And the data indicate that in some patients, you may go ahead with BRAF and MEK inhibition, followed by ipilimumab, nivolumab, and the results are as good as initial ipi-nivo. And once again, the question here was, why not give ipi-nivo? And the answer is very clear. The patient's performance status was simply too bad. So I believe it was a good decision to give Encobini in the first place. And now it was a bit risky. We were switching to ipi-nivo, but why not? We discussed it with the patient. After 4 doses, there was a loss of appetite, and there was nausea, some stomach pain, weight loss, and diarrhea. And the colonoscopy and gastroscopy has been performed. Again, we went for a calprotectin in the stool, and we did stool microbiology. And again, there was an autoimmune colitis and autoimmune duodenitis. The dose was the same, and the drug was the same, methylprednisolone, 2 mg/kg intravenously. And we did tumor reassessments, and a partial response was maintained. No significant changes for the metastases, and the brain MRI still showed no brain mets. So the tumor board decision was the therapy discontinuation for 3 months, but not with ipinevo, just with maintenance treatment. And this is what we did. We did the maintenance treatment with a 4-week schedule of nivolumab. And one of the reasons for this is, to be very honest, is the COVID crisis, because, you know, during the COVID crisis, we want to have long intervals where we are not seeing the patient in our outpatient unit. And this is the reason why we were giving the favor to the 4-week and not the 2-week scheme of nivolumab. In December 2021, there was a progressive disease, again detected, new necrotic pleural metastases, and a non-pleural metastasis with an ongoing partial remission. So it was a new lesion. Still no brain mets, and still S100 and LDH within normal ranges. This is the CT scan, which is quite impressive for the new metastasis. And the question was, what should we do next? And we switched back, which we call re-challenge or re-exposure or re-treatment, to the targeted therapies. And in this case, we used encobini because the tolerability was so good, with the exception of the left ventricular ejection fraction reduction. But this is not specific for encobini. It's the same for Dartrum and for vemurafenib and cobimetinib. So the cardiac function was now stable. And what you see now is in February 2022, a partial response of the neuropleural metastases and no change of all the other lesions. So here you see the difference, and I think it's obvious for everyone who's used to read CT scans that there is a partial response in this patient caused by the re-challenge of BRAF and MEK inhibitors. And the question is what to do now? Continue with the targeted therapies or switch back to immune checkpoint inhibition monotherapy or re-challenge of the combo with ipilimumab and nivolumab? This was the questions discussed in our interdisciplinary tumor board, and now we decided to continue with the targeted therapies in March 2022. And the last examinations were in September 2022, and there was still a regression, but not a complete response of all metastases. The patient continued encorafenib and binimetinib without laboratory or ECG abnormalities, and with CTC grade 1-2 fatigue, but no other sequela from the treatment. So I guess if you see the magnitude of the benefit within such a short time frame, it's a major success.
Just want to ask you about S100. To what extent is that an effective tumor marker in melanoma?
So I prepared my thesis in 1999 on S100 and other serum tumor markers, including, you know, PCR methods and LDH in comparison. S100 is more sensitive and more specific for melanoma than LDH, and it detects in the serum earlier as an indirect indicator for metastasis, a tumor load. It's not useful if you have micrometastasis in the central node, for instance. You cannot detect, you know, very small deposits of tumor cells with a serum marker, but also you cannot detect it with LDH. But in Europe, it's used widely, not only in Germany, but also in Scandinavia, in Austria, in Switzerland, in France, and in Italy, and in Spain. So, you know, S100 for us is a marker which we like to include for the monitoring, particularly of stage 3 and 4 patients.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Hauschild, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.